show you some writing. It's a popular novel. Don't get scared. Don't get frightened when I say book. I know many of you don't read. You just text. And you think that using your two thumbs makes you equal to Shakespeare. But before the two-thumb method, there was a thing called penmanship. Before the two-thumb message, there was a thing called books. Before the two-thumb message, there were movies based upon books. And the other night I couldn't sleep. It was around 1 in the morning. I got up and I watched a movie. And it was Prezi's Honor, which I had seen years ago and forgotten how good it was. And the reason I became fascinated again by Prezi's Honor is because it was written by probably one of the most, the finest novelists that I've ever read. In some ways, Richard Condon. Now, he wrote The Manchurian Candidate. He wrote Mile High, which I told you was about Prohibition and how it was created, how Prohibition had been created by a man who would then take over the rackets of, of the booze racket. He put in Prohibition. How? By funding women's groups who wanted to ban alcohol. And once the alcohol became illegal, he was ready with the smuggling the alcohol. And it's an amazing book, very much like the drugs in America today. Who knows who's funding the anti-drug hysteria in America? What do we really think? Shouldn't things really change? Why do you think there's such a battle against legalizing drugs? I mean, I'm not in favor of drug usage. I think it's a curse and a scourge, and it's destroyed our country. But you're at a point where you don't know what's destroying it more, the number of people incarcerated, the amount of police we have watching everything we do, or the drugs themselves. So anyway, so he wrote the Manchurian Candidate. He wrote Mile High, and he also wrote Prezi's Honor. So I started to read. So I watched the movie about 30 minutes, but then I pick up the novel. I just happened to get the three of his books in the hardcover again. I had ordered them. And I start to read Prezi's Honor, and I found out that the movie was very true to the book. They copied almost the work. See, Richard Condon was actually one of the screenwriters for the movie, directed, by the way, by John Huston, one of his funny, while he was still living. And his daughter, Angelica Huston, was in it. Jack Nicholson, if you remember, was in that movie. Now, remember, 1985 is a long time ago. 85, 95, 30, 25 years ago. It's hard to believe, right? If I say 1985, you believe it's 25 years ago. I do reversals and backwards now. So I say, 1985, why, that was just yesterday? No, it was 25 years ago. So I said, wait a minute, what does that really mean? Well, put yourself in 1985 and say 25 years ago, that would be 1960. Impossible to believe. Okay, so I'm going to read you from the book and I'm going to show you what good writing is. Just sitting in that hotel lobby under a shiny green balaboonal hat, which by itself could return millinery to a leading place in the arts, she had slowed down the lobby traffic, as Charlie could see from across the lobby, to minus 9 miles an hour. He studied everyone who was within sight of her in the room, pitying poor Paulie, and he imagined that he could see old men's eyes getting misty, room clerks and bystanders developing erections, and every woman who saw her realizing that she was doomed to hostile dreams that night. She had turned Charlie's legs to water just by sitting there when he came into the lobby. Now, that's the character, the Jack Nicholson character, and the femme fatale was played by Kathleen Turner, who I didn't think was that fantastic, but Charlie Partan is apparently in love with her, right? Now, I want to read you one sentence when he falls in love with her, and he flies out to L.A. to meet this woman he fell in love with at a wedding, a mob wedding, and he meets her in L.A., and he's courting her now. He's totally in love with her, absolutely in love with her after one day. So they get into a car after a restaurant, and they drive up the Pacific Coast Highway. I'm going to read you one paragraph. I want to show you what writing can do. They drove to the ocean, then up the Pacific Coast Highway, and Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he had ever felt in his life. Do you hear a sentence like this? I'm going to read it again. He's in love now. He's a gangster. He's a killer. And yet he's in love with this woman. They drove to the ocean, then up the Pacific Coast Highway, and Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he had ever felt in his life. I thought that was an amazing sentence. I don't know if people could even write about love in that way anymore, what it does to a human heart. The illusion of love, because it's all an illusion, as you well know. Remember, I started by saying we're going to talk about illusions and allusions. So now we have the illusion of romantic love and what physiological and emotional effect it has on this character. which Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he ever felt in his life. Now, maybe you remember those feelings from when you were 17. I don't know. Remember what it was like? When a girl liked you and you liked her? Oh, my God. They say the man feels he can conquer the world. Yeah, well, click, click, 3 years later, get back to me on that one. How about when love leaves you? How about when the illusion leaves you? What happens to the man or to the woman when that illusion, that romantic illusion, leaves you? Well, we could spend a lot of time talking about what love is and what love isn't and how it was a rather recent phenomenon. It didn't even exist in biblical times. The whole concept of love is kind of a modernistic idea. There was no love in the ancient days, incidentally. Love, the idea of romantic love, as I understand it, is rather recent, last few hundred years. For most of mankind throughout history, marriage was based upon something other than love, other than romantic love. And you could joke and say based upon lust. Okay, fine. We know that's a given. But it was based basically on a contract between a man and a woman, sort of a business contract, to go into business together, the business of raising a family and building lives. That's what marriage really is at the end of the day. And depending upon your business partner, your business will either thrive. Well, your business partner and luck and circumstances, of course. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. Oh, there's another great line in here. I got to read this to you. Hold it. Hold it. Listen to this one. So we're talking about Prezi's honor. And what's the dedication in the front of the book? Listen to this. You're going to love this one. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships from the book Antigone. Can you believe that? I'm going to read that to you again. Many of you think that you can lock out fate with money, or you can lock out fate with a guard or a security guard, or, you know, calling 911, or being surrounded by powerful people. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships. How many of you have not experienced that in your life? How many of you want to call this show right now and tell me what fate has done to you when least expected? How's that for a show topic? And the phone number, you know, 1-800-449-8255. I'll read it once again. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships, from Antigone. How has fate influenced your life? When has fate entered your life and turned it from one form to another? From poor to rich, from rich to poor, from health to sickness? From marriage to divorce? You want to go into what fate did to you? Now, I tell you, we all know about fate. Remember I read the story when I wrote years ago, 2 years ago was it already, Psychological Nudity, and I talked to you about the Leather Man. Many of you loved that story because it was so bittersweet. The father's friend, the Leather Man, who rose from the poverty of the Lower East Side where he didn't have a penny, and he became wealthier than my father did by going into a certain business which took off in the 1950s, and he moved to a much better house than we had. We lived in an attached house. He was able to move to a detached house, so to speak, out in Long Island, you know, with a lawn all around it as opposed to an attached wall. Now, that was considered much wealthier. While we had a used car, he had a new car. While we had a flat living room, he had a sunken living room. While we had a phonograph, he had a stereo. You get the picture, right? So things went on very well for him. Soon he had expanded the Leather Man. He had a chain of leather stores. And then lo and behold, as fate would have it, I go away. I go out on my own road. I travel to the Fiji Islands. I leave the entire kith and kin behind. I want to set out on my own road. I know if I stay in New York, I'd be dead within a short... I wouldn't be dead. My soul would be dead. I wouldn't have gotten anywhere in life. I just was not cut from the same cloth as my kin and kith. I wasn't. I was always different. I was always driven by other... Doesn't mean I'm better, okay? It means I'm different. It's as simple as that. So I had to follow my own star. Whatever the influences were, I knew I had to get out of New York. So I left in 67 or so, 68. And the rest was an astounding ride. What a roller coaster ride it's been. What I'm saying is I come back from that road to the plant collecting, the Fiji, the Samoa, the Tahiti, the plant. And now I'm a man. I have a child. I'm married. I had left when I was still really a boy. And the Leather Man had been riding high. I come back a few years later. I am sitting in my living room. I think my father was dead, or actually, to tell you the truth, I think I came back from my father's funeral. Truthfully, I mean, I don't remember. A lot of it's jumbled up in my head. And lo and behold, who's sitting there, shrunken up in the chair? The Leatherman, who, by the way, I'm not here to mock him. I love this man. I loved all of my father's friends. There wasn't one man in the entire circle that I didn't have a fondness for. I loved all of these guys. I loved all of my uncles. It was an amazing time. I don't know what's happened to the world. But I had a big heart for these people. They were all kindly, good guys. So anyway, he's sitting there, shrunken down. He was a heavy cigar smoker. Heavy cigar smoker. And he looks up at me, and his eyes are wandering, and he says, Michael, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. I didn't know what happened to him. He says, I have nothing. I lost everything. And he wound up living at this point now with his children back in a relative's apartment in the slums of New York that he had left 30 years before. He lost his house. He lost his business. Everything. The fortunes had changed. Fate had changed. And here he was. His eyes were bewildered. He didn't know how this could happen to him. And he looked at me and he said, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. Then he says this. Then he says, I wish God had only given me cancer instead of this. I said, don't say that. Well, lo and behold, he was dead within a year from brain cancer. That's an absolutely true story. It's in Psychological Nudity. It's an example of what fate is, and not tempting fate. And don't ask God for something because he's liable to hear you.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from August 2010 from the Savage Nation. So, where was I? Oh, so I was talking about fate. That was one of the things. I mean, I've touched on an awful lot in this show so far. And many of you probably didn't know where I was coming from when I said we're going to do books. But I told you that if we do something that's of interest to me, it will lead back and forth in and out of the news and current events anyway. It's all interrelated. I could read the Bible and show you how the Bible is related to what's going on in the world today. I can show you that in and out and out and in. But again, that's too obvious. That's too hucksterish. And so I'm not going to do it. I don't really want to do the hokum thing. You know, I'm not Marjo. I'm not the Marjo of talk radio. Look up Marjo. It was a very funny movie in its day. You know, the revival tent guy. I don't want to do Marjo. You know, there are people in the business who are very good Marjos. So if you want to call the show, we can talk. I wanted to hear from fate. That's right. Like if I were driving in a car somewhere in America, let's say I was the man who owned $25 billion worth of gold and I hate Michael Savage and I'm tuning in to see if he's putting me down again and wants me arrested. And all of a sudden the guy's talking about fate and this and that. And he reads from the book where he said nothing can stop fate. In other words, was that true? Can nothing stop fate? How many times has fate turned people's fortunes around? People have thought that they were immune, couldn't be touched. So I gave you an example of a pedestrian example in my family constellation, in my childhood's constellation of what fate has done. We're all touched by fate. Now, I don't want to tempt fate, but I myself am not as believing in fate as much as I am in self-determination, truthfully. I truly believe in willpower altering fate. Let me put it to you that way. Because if you start to believe that everything is fateful or predestined, well, you may as well, you know, just be a nothing, you know. You may as well just collect the old government check and eat the government cheese, you know, and press D, that's all, and scream about the rich that they owe you something. I have seen in my own life that I had to put a lot of effort into things to move the earth. I don't want to give you the hokey thing, but when I was way down, no matter what I did, I was like I called myself, well, God, there's so much I want to say. This has opened up so much in my own talking and thinking, I don't even know where to begin. I have recently recollected all of my journals. I'd lost them. I collected all of my writings going back to 1966. I've collected them. And they're all neatly assorted in various boxes. And I don't know whether I'm getting ready to do something or leave the earth. I really don't know why I'm doing it all. I have a new assistant who broke into a storage shed for me and found them. I thought I had lost a lot of this. Every writing I've ever had that's significant, all my journals and whatnot. So I remember the early days of writing and how my life was altered by fate and by certain events. But I remember I had a friend who really never amounted to anything. I don't particularly like the guy. He's a backstabber. I won't mention him. But I remember him writing that life is like you're like a leaf in a stream, he wrote, when we were both trying to be writers. And we're nothing but a leaf in a stream, and we get caught up in the stream, and wherever the stream takes us, that's where we end up as a leaf. That never struck me as the way I wanted to look at my life. It is certainly true that no matter what you do, sometimes things are not going to work out the way you want them. I don't know how many years I tried and struggled in so many different ways, and it was fruitless in some regard. And I used to write in my journals that I am like a wildcatter. I'm like an early Texas wildcatter. And every well that I have drilled has come up dry. And I remember writing it after 15 years of trying to hit pay dirt. I was hitting dry wells. And remember, I had two children. I did everything right. I got the degrees. I got the PhD from a great university. I published books. But society had changed on me. The left wing had taken over America. And no longer did work count. No longer did quality count. No longer did effort count. No longer did anything count other than race and gender. And so they started to push unqualified women and minorities into positions that they were not qualified for. It was called affirmative action. And they ruined my life for many years.
Well, we better put that aside for a minute. I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Germany, 1967. The children of the Nazi generation have grown up in the ruin their parents created. They vowed fascism would never rule their country again. In their fight for freedom, they lost themselves in the cause.
Da sind mehr von uns drin als draußen.
And ignited a revolution around the world. The Baader-Meinhof Complex, based on the true story of the Red Army faction.
Come on, pigs of Western civilization. Eat more grease. Eat more marbled sirloin, more pork and gravy. Lard up the dressing. Fried chicken in boiling oil. Carry it dribbling to gray climes, snowed with salt. Little lambs covered with mint roast in racks, surrounded by roast potatoes wet with butter sauce. Buttered veal medallions in creamy saliva. Buttered beef by glistening mountains of French fries. Right. Stroganoffs in white hot sour cream. Chops soaked in olive oil. Surrounded by olives. Salty feta cheese. Followed by Roquefort Blue and Stilton. Thirsty for wine, beer, Coca-Cola, Fanta, champagne, Pepsi, Retsina, Arak, whiskey, vodka. Ah!
You know the day destroys the night. Night divides the day.
I don't know how one old hippie listening to this show can't be having a great time. Welcome back to the Savage Nation, all you old hippies. All you young hippies. All you future hippies. All you non-hippies. All you ex-hippies. And all you Obama hippies. Welcome to the Savage Nation. So here I am, trying to show you the connection between Obama and the Marcuse school of quiet socialism that has gone on in this country, and how he is... Let us hope the last in a long line of those who have gone into the administration, into the system to corrupt it and overturn it and turn it into a socialist system. He was not the first, but let's hope that Obama, being so radical and so immature and trying to push through so much so fast, has awakened the sleeping giant of America. All the men who packed the silos with corn finally have awakened to what has happened to their country. All of the men who raise pigs and cows and wheats and soy. All of the men and women who drive the tractors and drive the trucks. All the men who ride jackhammers and work on the high rises, the low rises, ride the low riders, the high riders. In other words, all of America finally waking up to the fact that we're all about to descend into slavery in this country, all under the hands of this guy pretending to be Robin Hood when he's nothing but a shill for the New World Order socialists who have virtually taken over all avenues of this government, in my opinion. Of course, it's only one man's opinion, and I recognize that many of you will not accept what I am saying. You'll say, come on, get off it. Don't exaggerate. Don't be a drama queen. He's just trying to take away some of the excess in the medical system and
make it more fair. Well, that's one way to look at it, except when you really look at it, which you haven't done, and I did, because I do it for a living. I looked at it. The premiums go up. The care goes down. The government decides whether you live or die. There is no reining in the greedy, disgusting, verminous tort lawyers. There's no limitation on health care for the illegal alien parasites who have invaded America and don't deserve anything for free, but they're going to get it. So don't tell me this is about fairness. This is about a ripoff, to use a 60s phrase. But I don't want to get too excited. I just want to have a good time. Because boys just want to have a good time, and I'm just going to have a good time. And so I want to go back to Freud's idea of pansexualism, because if I say sex, I'm going to get your attention even more than I already have it. And so one of the main ideas of the Frankfurt School of socialism under Herbert Marcuse, the grandfather, the philosophical grandfather of Obama, was to exploit Freud's idea of pansexualism, which I tried to tell you a little bit about, you know, attack the authority of the father, search for pleasure at all costs, always tell the people that they deserve pleasure, should have pleasure, must have pleasure, will have pleasure, don't deny pleasure, pleasure's the reason you're not feeling good, your doctor says have pleasure, how come you're not having pleasure, why don't you have pleasure, why are you denying pleasure, have pleasure, do it in the road, wherever it feels good, do it, have it in the road, do it in the road, sex is good for you, have pleasure, do pleasure, be pleasure, you are pleasure, you are only the pleasure principle, you're all id, you're no ego, you're no superego, you're nothing but a walking id, you're nothing but a walking id, you're nothing but a walking id, have pleasure, have pleasure, have pleasure, have pleasure. Porn here, porn there. Here's porn, there's porn. Eat candy, do candy. Here's drugs. Here's porn, there's porn. Everywhere, porn, porn. Once there were Gideon Bibles, now there's porn even in Marriott hotels. Here's the porn, have some pleasure. It's good for you. Destroys the marriage, destroys the family, destroys the kids. All part of the socialist objective. Have some porn, here's some porn. Want some porn? Want some porn? Here's some porn. Turn the porn on. Corporate accounts, turn the porn on. The school believed there were two types of revolution, A, political, and B, cultural. Cultural revolution demolishes a society from within. Does that sound like something that you understand? Family, education, media, sex, popular culture. Has there been a revolution or hasn't there been? Well, that's what we're talking about. That's why a guy like me, a guy who went through the 60s and was kind of like, wait a minute, where are we going with this? Who's behind this? Who lived through the whole peace and love bull crap of the 1960s and saw the guys with the peace signs in their hands who were the drug dealers, the guys who try to rip off your old lady, the guys who try to break into your house when you turned your back. Oh, but they had the long hair and they had the hippie glasses. I wasn't conned for 1 minute. I was never taken in by it. Let's all share, man. As long as it was your stuff they were sharing. I know the whole game. Believe me, I know where they're coming from. Nobody hates hippie pigs more than I do. So don't think you're fooling me or you Berkeleyite phony. Okay, I'll stop right there. So there was a political and a cultural revolution. And what does that mean today? What it means today is that the witch hunt that you are seeing on today's campuses, the witch hunt you are seeing, for example, going on against Michael Savage wherever you turn, the blacklisting of Michael Savage in Britain, the blacklisting by certain advertising agency, the fear amongst certain people about Michael Savage, all unfounded because I'm actually the true patriot. I'm actually representative of America. They've tried to demonize me, and they've done so with many people because they control the media. So the witch hunts that are going on today in the media on the campuses is the implementation of Marcuse's concept of repressive toleration. Write this one down. What is repressive toleration? It is the tolerance for movements from the left, but intolerance for movements from the right. And that is exactly what we're living through on the universities in the media. Tolerance for movements from the left, but intolerance for movements from the right. So they tolerate vermin at MSNBC who are talentless left-wing Obamaite hacks, and they demonize a guy like Michael Savage, who is revered and loved by millions of people who have a brain and are not drug-addled. I take you back in time to the Biedermannhof gang in Germany in the 70s. You don't have to actually know who Bieder was or who Meinhof was to understand what I'm about to tell you. I'll just tell you in short, the Biedermannhof gang was a radical left-wing group of machine gunners and bombers who attacked the middle class, kidnapped, all in the name of peace, justice, and love. Now, they supported the Arab cause. They hated Jews in Israel. They claimed they hated Zionism, not Jews, but of course they hated Jews and Zionism, being the grandchildren or the children of Nazis. They really didn't fall far from the tree. Although they posed as leftists, who are out for social justice and in favor of the third world
and the third world liberation theology, by the way, which Obama was fed for 20 straight years at his church, in his colleges, etc., liberation theology. You heard all of that, third world liberation theology. It's exactly what Obama was bred and schooled in. And the Obama-Biden-Monhoff connection is what I want to talk about today. So that when we talk about the health care bill, which is going to come up over and over again, you have to understand how this connects to the radicals going back to the Biden-Monhoff gang, who were influenced by the writings of Mao Zedong and the philosophers associated with what is called the Frankfurt School, and Marxist philosophers such as Herbert Marcuse. Now, many of you have heard of Herbert of Saul Alinsky and Bill Ayers, but you may not have heard of Herbert Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse was the founder of the Frankfurt School of Marxist theory. And one of the main ideas of the Frankfurt School was that instead of outright revolution and social disruption, the left would allow society to continue providing goods and services and to defend the nation, while they, the left-wing intellectuals, would take charge of education, manipulate the public with media propaganda, corrupt morality through the entertainment industry, and infiltrate government bureaucracy at all levels. Does it sound familiar? This is exactly what Barack Obama has succeeded in doing. He's not the first, but he certainly should be the last in this long line of Marxist revolutionaries who have been in the White House. I would say Bill Clinton was the first. We also know that Obama's childhood mentor, Frank Marshall Davis, was a member of the Communist Party. We know that Obama admits attending, quote, socialist conferences. We know that Obama admits reading Marxist literature. We know that Obama became a community organizer and came into contact with the Democratic Socialists of America, who then endorsed his campaign for Illinois State Senate. And we know that Obama became friends with William Ayers, a member of the socialist group Students for Democratic Society, which was a violent group, by the way. And yet now Obama has infiltrated government bureaucracy to the highest level of all. The Biden-Monhoff gang used violence to try to achieve socialism, and they failed. They were defeated. But Obama was more faithful to Herbert Marcuse and his plan to infiltrate government peacefully, and he has succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. And so that is why I want to talk about Obama and the reverse Robin Hood myth and the health care proposal and the Maoists, Marxists, and other communists known as czars in the administration, and what you can do about it.
Savage.
Savage University of Higher Learning. So we're going beyond the day-to-day because it's of interest. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? See, if you focus, okay, Obama's pushing to give to the poor and he's just a nice guy trying to help those who don't have and take from the pigs on the top. That's one scenario, but it's all false because, as I pointed out, is there one poor person listening to this show who's benefited at all from Obama? I don't think so. There are none. He's actually trying to steal from the middle class to give to the rich, to the cronies who put him in power. It came out that Obama's called for increasing payroll taxes on households earning less than $250,000. And that's an apparent breach of his oft-repeated pledge. He will also increase taxes on interest, dividends, annuities, royalties, and rents, all aimed at those making less than $250,000. So he violated another one of his primary campaign goals, that he was not targeting the middle class, which he is. But you say, well, okay, we understand that, and that's good. But I want to take it back so you know where we're going. See, if you don't know where he's coming from, and you just, like, get shocked every day by another slap from Obama and his Marxist minions, you're not going to know where they want to take you. This is a revolution that's going on in America, and it's not good for anybody. The revolution ends badly for everybody. And so, as I say to you, this is a quiet cultural revolution, not one of violence. Although you could argue that instead of unleashing the Biden-Monhoff gang with bombs in the streets, he's unleashed the military on Afghanistan. I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but one could make that analogy. What's interesting to me about the war in Afghanistan is this. Where are the street protests? How come there was such a huge outcry against the Iraq war
from the radical phony leftists, and there's hardly a peep out of them now. The answer is because they were never against the war in Iraq. They're only against Republicans and Bush. And because now that the Democrats are running the war, the bombs have D's on them, and therefore the bombs are good bombs. Any bomb with a D on it is a good bomb. Any bomb with a D, any bullet with a D on it is a good bullet. It doesn't really matter to them. They were never against the war. They were against Republicans and Bush. And so, again, they were just trying to undermine the Republican administration, which they did do. They undermined the war on terror, which is why we now have a civil trial for one of the worst mass murderers in history, a man who masterminded, on our soil, rather, he masterminded the 9/11 attacks, and yet they have sympathy for him, while Lieutenant Behenna has absolutely no support, and he's rotting in Fort Leavenworth. It's interesting to me that many of my listeners were self-identified liberals of the 60s, and they don't really know what their identity is today. They're not really a leftist or a progressive because they know that most of them are phonies, and it's all hot air rhetoric that's used to grift people out of things. But they're not willing to say they're a conservative, and I don't blame them because when you see the fake conservatives out there, I know they don't want to identify with that. So they call themselves an independent or a moderate, which is probably more close to the truth than it is. But many of my listeners who call themselves moderate or libertarians or independents are actually liberals. They're actually true liberals. What you don't understand is that the whole definition of what a liberal is has changed. So let's not worry so much about definitions. Let's worry instead or focus instead on what a hardcore Maoist, Marxist, socialist is and what he wants to do to the United States of America and what he is actually doing under the guise of helping people get health care right now. And so you have to go back to Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School, okay? And so the Frankfurt School was a conspiracy to take over a country through a quiet cultural revolution, not through violence, as was done by the Biedermannhof gang and the other members of the Red Brigade. And I want to talk about this again over and over again today because it's so important for you to know the danger you're actually in. Give me some hard hippie music of the 60s.
The Constitution, well, you know, we all want to change your head. You tell me it's the Institution.
Okay, so you get the picture. So even the Beatles were singing songs about revolution, encouraging the youth to drop the mores of the middle class, to overthrow their parents' strictures, to tell everyone that they were free and liberated and they were going to, you know, bring about a new order, a new society. And what they don't understand is they actually have brought about a new order and a new society. And who's sitting here listening to the show could say it's a better order and a better society than the one that your parents had? I'd like to know anyone listening to the show tells me you're living in a safer world, a cleaner world, a more moral world, because it just is not true. So I want to go back to what I said before. All of this stems back to the Frankfurt School. We talked about that. We talked about the new left guru of the 60s, Herbert Marcuse. And now I want to advance what they built their Frankfurt School of Socialism upon, which was Freud's idea of pansexualism, the search for pleasure. The search for pleasure became one of the operational methodologies to break people's social mores down, because if they broke you down morally, they could break you down every other way, and they could remold you in the form of the new man that the socialists have always talked about. And so they continue to teach you to search for pleasure. To do this, they exploited the differences between the sexes. They try to overthrow the traditional relationships between men and women. And to further their aims, we read, here's what they were going to do: attack the authority of the father, deny the specific roles of father and mother, take away from families their rights as primary educators of their children, abolish the differences in the education of boys and girls, abolish all forms of male dominance, such as the presence of women in the armed forces. And by the way, we read that this dingbat defense secretary is now pushing the submarine fleet to put women on submarines. They're going to have to accommodate women by rebuilding the submarines to accommodate women. But here we are. Got excited, found a Sauvignon Blanc I could drink. Lorenzo makes one. I didn't get a headache. I mean, that to me is a miracle. I can drink wine again. I feel liberated. I said, Lorenzo, do you use malolactic fermentation? No, I don't use a... No malolactic fermentation. I said, good. Thank God. No headache-o. No malolactic-o, no headache-o. That's all I know. Because I gave up on the New Zealand wines. They became too fruity. I don't know, it was with the lemon-lime. I felt like I was drinking 7-Up. Years ago when I used to drink wine, I'm slipping into the food now. Okay, I do it. I can't find a good white wine anymore. 20 years ago, I used to drink, if I was lucky, I went to someone's house, they had a Grand Cru Chablis. We drank a lot of French Chablis when it was really good. Then there was the Grand Cru Chablis, which a professor friend had. I never heard anything like it. Then there was Batard Chasson. It was unbelievable, white wines then. Then all of a sudden, something happened with the white wine. They became, I don't know what they did to them, creamy, fruity. Sorry to tell you, a lot of the children who grew up drinking soda started drinking wine. They didn't like the actual taste of wine. They wanted a soda with alcohol. So it's hard to find, you know. There's no such thing. And New Zealand used to make a great, when it was the Marlboro New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, it was a different story with a slight tinge of the limey in it, you know. Even though the limey's made, it was a slight tinge of limey. Then all of a sudden now it's like soda. It's like a lemon limey. It's like drinking on a machine in a it's like going for lemon limey in a Lois Pitkin. You are listening to the Savage Nation, the one and only Savage Nation.
Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. Here is the best of the Savage Nation from August 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now, people say to me, I'm off the record now. I mean, on the record. I'm on the radio show talking to so many people, and I speak with you as though we're in a room together. People are worried. I run into people, otherwise intelligent people. Some are very successful, some modest, or whatever. And they say to me, what's going on? Is Obama a traitor? Why in the heck is he spending so much emphasis on the mosques and on Muslims? Why is he permitting the State Department to prosecute Sheriff Joe in Arizona? Why is he catering to the most violent extremists in Mexico and in the Islamic world? Is he a traitor? They ask me that. I just shake my head. I don't even want to answer them. And then they say to me, what's going to happen? How is this going to end? The currency is worthless, they say to me. They all know. Everyone, look, I'm reaching in my right pocket. I'm taking out a stack of 20s and 10s, whatever was in my pocket. Ones, right? I never carry a lot of money. I like cash. I grew up on a cash card. So I have the credit card. To me, it still looks like a $20 bill. Most people look at it, they say it's a green piece of paper. It has no value whatsoever. So therefore, what's our currency worth? It's based on faith. Then you have a government that says, here's our faith, and it will show you what we the faith we have. We're going to print as much of it as we need to continue the Ponzi scheme. Although the Ponzi scheme is what broke the economy, we're going to create another one by printing money. It has no basis in value. It's not backed by gold since Nixon. It's not backed on anything anymore. So people are worried, what will happen to you? What's going to happen? And they say, do you think we could wind up like in Germany in the Weimar Republic, where a person needed a wheelbarrow pushing a wheelbarrow full of German marks, to buy a loaf of bread? Took hundreds of thousands of German marks to buy a loaf of bread because the currency had become that worthless. Or I remember when I was young and I went to Italy, how almost comedic it looked to me when I saw Italian currency, printed currency, in larger sizes. So 1,000 liras was a smaller note than 10,000 liras, which was smaller than 100,000 liras. Leave it to the Italians. In other words, the size of the paper indicated the value of the dollar. Of the lira at that time, which I thought was funny. I mean, I didn't understand it until eventually the largest bill you carry was like a lettuce, like a roll of lettuce in your pocket. So you say, well, is that what they're going to do? Well, you look at the franc. Why do you think the French, I say to myself and say to people who talk to me for my opinion, asking my opinion, I'm giving you the plain truth. My opinion is all you're going to get out of me on this radio show. I'm not running for office. I have no end in sight. I mean, I have no end. I don't want anything from you.
I don't want anything from you. I'm only giving you one man's opinion. So here it is. Here's the opinion. Tell me about the French franc. Well, it turns out that, for example, there's a thing called a franc and a new franc, and an old franc and a new franc. What's a new franc? The time when I first went to France, when I was very young, 18, 19, I don't remember when, big trip to Europe, you know, writer, this and that, cafes, cigarettes, Galoisie, motor scooter, leotards, black, you know, black leotards, girls, wine, women's song, blah, blah, blah. The franc had been revalued at some point after World War II. They created what was known as a new franc because they couldn't support the government, couldn't support itself based on the old franc. So they made every franc all of a sudden was worth 10 francs. Could that happen here? Could we wake up and find out that Greenspan so wrecked the economy? And the other fellow at the SEC whose name you have forgotten, who has disappeared like into the woodwork, or Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary? Could it be that we'll wake up one day and the $20 bill that I have in my pocket, which I'll take out right now, this $20 bill will suddenly become the equivalent of a $2 bill? Will that become the equivalent of 20 old francs? And then suddenly the government will churn out a new bill that says 20 new francs, 20 new dollars. It won't have a picture of Jackson on it. It'll have a picture of Reverend High Jackson on it. And then maybe the $10 bill will have Reverend Sharpton or maybe an imam on it. Maybe Iman Ralph would be on it instead of Hamilton. It'll be 10 old dollars, and it'll be the 10 new dollars. This 10 old dollars becomes worth a dollar. Hey, that's a good way to balance the economy if you're Alan Greenspan and your old lady works for MSNBC. What do you care? Doesn't matter to you. You have so much money. What does it matter whether it's old dollars or new dollars? Presto. So it has been done before. Don't think it can't happen here. It could happen here. And under Pinocchio, it's liable to happen here. Pinocchio's enjoying himself eating lobster, and Mrs. Pinocchio's guzzling champagne and eating ice cream, like Marie Antoinette, someone wrote, and comes back and goes to the vegetable garden and tells you to eat light off the earth, and children are too fat, and then goes in the kitchen for the cherry vanilla. He tells you to tighten your belt, and he goes and rents a $50,000 a week house, tells you to tighten your belt. And America right now is very, very upset with this administration. So what does it matter to him if his money men say, you know what, make the $20 bill, make a new $20 bill, we're going to print the new $20 bill, and it'll be called 20 new dollars. And how that works is you go into a store, and you pull out one that I have in my pocket, a Jackson, and it's no longer a $20 bill, it's a 20 old dollar bill, which is now worth the equivalent of $2. And you have to have a 20 new dollar bill for it to be worth 20 new dollars. Can't happen here. It has happened there. And since it's happened there, why can't it happen here, I ask myself. So that's one thing I say to people. Then they say to me, well, what about throwing the bums out in November? I said, I doubt it. I doubt the Democrats are going to be. Everyone knows they're corrupt and un-American. How could you say that? I said, answer, war. What do you mean war? They ask me. I said, well, study history. Every country, including our own, that's gotten into trouble financially has gone to war. Oh, I got a pain in my side. I hope it's not fatal. No, I'm joking. It was a bad turkey sandwich I had for lunch from a local market. I hate cold food. I hate cold food. I can't stand it. I couldn't eat any more hot food. I'm sick of Chinese. I'm sick of Japanese food. I'm just sick of it all. So I said, all right, they say, go get me a turkey sandwich. Horrible. I made a mistake. Ugh. Sandwiches are impossible to digest. I need hot food. I was watching a show last night on how cooked food altered human beings' fate. I couldn't believe it. It's very interesting. I mean, I'm not new to that discussion because I remember Claude Levi-Strauss's anthropological great book, The Raw and the Cooked, where Claude Levi-Strauss, in his argument, stated that it was cooked food that changed mankind, the course of human events, which it did. Prior to that, there was raw food, and how the fire itself and the cooking of food changed man. I mean, civilization was altered, etc., and cities were built as a result of the cooked food. Now, that's very interesting, particularly when you see us going backwards with the lunatics in the various left-leaning areas of the world, in America, where the schmucks are eating raw food and they think they're superior. And they come up with cockamamie discussions about enzymes. The enzymes are only found in raw food and not in cooked food. You take a look at them. They're emaciated. They can't go to the bathroom. They can't reproduce. They got pimples at the age of 50. They don't have a girlfriend. They don't have a boyfriend. They don't have a dog. But they eat raw food. They have no idea what they're talking about. Raw food is good for you. And they talk about it with a certain religiosity where they're positive that they know what they're talking about, that the enzymes are only found in raw foods. And when you cook it, you destroy the enzymes. Rubbish. In fact, the opposite is true. If you know how to cook, you're actually releasing enzymes that are trapped in foods, incidentally. I'm not saying boil out all of the vitamins from food. But I'm talking there's a way to cook and preserve the vitamin content of food. But anyway, so the raw and the cooked side, this is an interesting side note. They do a study with, I think, mice in a cage, which, well, what are mice? Ah, whatever, they have nothing to do there. They kill mice. That's why I left pharmacology back in 1968, because I had to pith the brain of mice, and I wouldn't do it. You don't realize who you're listening to. I worked in a laboratory, and I was a grad student making $300 a month as a fellowship. That was a total money I had, and the evil professor said to me, now you have to kill the mice after the experiment, or I'm going to fire you. I said, you can't do that to me. I'm 6,000 miles from home. I have no money. He said, I don't care where you're from, what you're doing. You're killing the mice after we run the experiments. I said, well, I'm not doing it. He said, you're fired. So you talk about fate? I left the pharmacology lab because I wouldn't kill the mice. I refused to kill the mice. They were so cute. And I said, what the hell am I going to do now? I have no money. I have no fellowship. I've lost my fellowship 2 months into the year. I'm 6,000 miles from home. Well, I wandered the halls of the university. I wound up in the basement looking at jars of roots and herbs and leaves. I thought they were interesting. This one said Samoa, that said Fiji, that said Tahiti. And I wandered into a very nice laboratory, a nice man's laboratory, or laboratory's office, a very nice man. And I asked him, what the heck is this? I said, I'm in a science building here. What are all these roots and herbs? He says, well, those are collected down in Samoa by a certain professor we have. And he sends them back to us for analysis where we're looking for medicines. I said, what is that called, that field? He said, well, it's called ethnobotany. I said, you're kidding me. Then you get paid to do that? He said, yes. So because I wouldn't kill mice, I shifted over to botany. And I wound up doing ethnobotany. And I wound up traveling to the Fiji Islands and Tonga, where I wrote my master's thesis on the ethnobotany of Tonga, which is still a classic, a minor classic. It was actually published in a journal from Harvard University, when Harvard was still Harvard, which it still is, by the way, in certain areas of science. And that was my fate. I wouldn't kill mice, so my fate took me in the direction of botany because I didn't think I'd have to kill anything. And, of course, I mean, that's what fate is. I mean, was it fate? Or was it me driving my own fate by following my own lodestone, so to speak? You want to put it to you that way, or my own compass? And that's it. I mean, life is interesting how it is. And now I'm at a turning point in my life again. And I think that within the year, by the end of the year, a new fate's operating in my life right now. And I believe something new is coming in my life. I've been thinking a lot, dreaming a lot about singing. I told you that. I don't know where it's coming from. Remember I told you last week I was dreaming I was in the street singing? I was an itinerant singer singing opera. Not even for money or acclaim. I wasn't winding up in the Lincoln Center singing opera. I was singing in the street for the enjoyment of singing opera in the street. Why? What do I know why? Last night, again, I dreamed I was singing somewhere. I mean, I have a good voice. It's not trained to sing, but I may take up singing and leave radio and become a singer. What am I going to do?
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from August 2010 from the Savage Nation.
Now I want to talk about allusions. Now, what do I mean by allusions? Well, allusions in Western literature. Don't turn the show off because you think you're back in high school. You're just beginning your learning. And I know many people are going to enjoy this. I'm going to give you an example. Let's start with a book title that many of you may still remember. It's called The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, one of the great novelists of all time. And the title of the novel, The Sun Also Rises, where does it come from? The title comes from the Old Testament, the Bible, Ecclesiastes 1:5, where it's written, "The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose." So Hemingway was a good Midwestern boy, who grew up going to church, who had a good a good, solid education, not only in high school, which was greater than most of the college educations today, but biblical education as well. And he used that to his advantage as a great novelist. I'll give you another example that of a title that goes back quite a ways. Here is, for example, where's the second one? The Sun Also Rises comes from the Bible. Now let's look at the next title, The Day of the Locust. Did you ever hear The Day of the Locust by Nathaniel West? It was a 1939 novel set in Hollywood, California during the Great Depression. And it depicted the alienation and desperation of a group of people who exist at the fringes of the movie industry. The title, The Day of the Locust, is likely a biblical allusion to certain passages in the Old Testament. The most famous literary or historical reference to locusts is in the book of Exodus in the Bible, in which God sends a plague of locusts to the Pharaoh of Egypt as retribution for refusing to free the enslaved Jews. Millions of locusts swarm over the lush fields of Egypt, destroying its food supply. Nathaniel West's use of the locust in his title brings up images of destruction and a land, Hollywood, stripped bare of anything green and living. And that's another one that may be tied back to the Bible in The Day of the Locust. So I'm going to just continue and show you some more illusions, or shall I say allusions, in Western literature. We talked about The Sun Also Rises from the Bible. We talked about The Day of the Locust, which is probably biblical in its reference. How about the title For Whom the Bell Tolls, Hemingway's novel about the Spanish Civil War, is an allusion, not illusion, an allusion to a passage from Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions by English poet John Donne. Now, John Donne became an Anglican priest in 1615, and here's what he wrote. No man is an island entire of itself. Each is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thine own or of thine friends were. Each man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind. Therefore, send not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. So Hemingway took that, and he wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls. How about the book The Winter of Our Discontent, published in 1961, written by John Steinbeck, his last novel? Title, reference to the line, Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the son of York, from William Shakespeare's Richard III. The Grapes of Wrath, where'd that come from? Another great title, many of you have some memory of it. The Grapes of Wrath is a reference to the Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Now, what is that all about? These lyrics, to me, refer to the biblical passage in Revelation 25, which is, And in the eyes of the hungry there is a growing wrath. In the souls of the people the grapes of wrath are filling. And growing heavy for the vintage. Wow, does that sound like America today? You hear this? And in the eyes of the hungry, there is a growing wrath. In the souls of the people, the grapes of wrath are filling, and growing heavy for the vintage. So it's not that people are starving in America. What they're starving for is truth. They're starving for leadership.
Savage.
Volare. Oh, oh.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Blue, dipinto di blu, e che dici di stare lassù? E volavo, volavo, venice un'alte del sole.
Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Mentre molto pian piano sparivo lontano lassù. Una musica dolce suonare soltanto per me.
Volare. Oh, cantare. Oh,
nel blu,
dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù. E volavo, volavo.
Hey,
what is this?
Sole ancora più su.
Mentre il mondo piano, piano spariva lontano laggiù. Una musica dolce.
Musica dolce che suona per me.
Volare. Oh. Cantare.
Cantare.
Oh.
Oh.
Oh,
oh, oh.
Nel blu.
Nel blu.
Dipinto del blu. Felice di stare lassù.
Nel blu degli occhi tuoi blu.
Gnocchi for you. All right, knock it off, Mario. Get back in the kitchen. Let's go to WTNT. TNT, what a station title that is, huh? What an acronym that is. Mike in Washington, D.C. on TNT. What's on your mind, Mike?
Michael, Michael, Don Calamari sends his best to you, my son.
Wait, who?
Don Calamari.
Don Calamari, you mean Scungili.
No, Scungili's on the West Coast, Calamari's on the East Coast.
You're not really Italian. If you're confusing Calamari with Scungili, you're faking it.
I'm a real Italian, Mike.
All right, but you're mixing up Calamari. Okay, I accept that. Forgive me for the bad insult. Calamari is calamari. It's a form of squid. Scungili is a form of a clam.
Of course.
Have you ever actually had Scungili?
Mike, I'm from downtown.
Oh, now you're giving me the whisper of job. I don't know who this is already. Thanks for the call, my friend. I don't like cutesy. I don't like people who talk to their children cutesy. It makes me squirm. You ever hear these parents talk to their children with, like, cute talk? That's why the child winds up a psycho. You know, I got to tell you a little trick about child rearing. In my opinion, one man's opinion, and I haven't done so bad. Speak to them as you would an adult, and they will grow up more intelligent. And they will be more competent younger. You ever listen to the people with the children? I love the ones who take them to a restaurant and give them a lesson in front of you to show how smart they are. How smart the child is with the pencils and the coloring book. You're spending $29 for a plate of spaghetti that costs 4 cents. And there they are next to you. The guy with the ponytail, he's 63, with a 30-year-old girl he met somewhere at a club. And right away, a year later, they have the baby. And 4 years later, ready the coloring book and the crayons in the pasta palace. And they're all set up. They got the whole thing. They got the backpack. They got the diaper at your next table. And they got the coloring book and the crayons, which should be outlawed in restaurants. It's not ding-dong school. Not everything is a ding-dong school. There was a time, and I raised children. I wasn't allowed in certain restaurants with the children when they were young. I didn't like it. But I understood it. People didn't want to be disturbed by children. Now, if they get sued, if they say to the people, you know what, we'd rather you not change doo-doo at the table, right away they call ACLU or a lawyer like an ACLU, or like a smarter one than an ACLU lawyer, the brother who went into private practice with the same mentality. Marvin goes into the ACLU because he's stupid, and Barry goes into the private practice and sues, but they're the same mentality. Two heads of the same hydra. That's it, the coloring books in the restaurant. How do you spell Louisiana, Louise? Very good. And then the mother claps at the desk. You hear this? This is where you're sitting having a romantic meal. $29.95 for the pasta al ripoffo. Antipasto consisting of a piece of old rotten cheese from Brooklyn that they couldn't sell to the Italians in New York because they know better. So they ship it to San Francisco. That's $9.95 for one little piece of mozzarella cheese. And a tomato. They give it an Italian name. $9.95 with a tomato and one little piece of cheese that the Italians rejected on the wharf. Even the wharf rats rejected it, but they can sell it in San Francisco. And $29.95 for pasta al creato. I don't mind it, all right? But you're going in for the ambience. No one's there for the food. They're in for the ambience. But the coloring book is there right away. And the lessons you have to listen to. Do you ever hear these lessons at these tables? Does this go on in Louisiana or only in the major cities? That you have to listen to these impossible parents. I never talk cute to the children. Okay, I'm a product of my upbringing. Harsh, Spartan-like. Don't be cute. I don't like cute. No jokes. Just get back to work. No matter what I did, I tried to entertain my friend. All right, get back to work. Stop the entertainment. He knew I was trying to, like, wiggle out of work by entertaining him. All right, that's very good. Now get back to it. No radio. On the way into work, I swear to God, if I was, like, driving in his car, I don't know how old I was. He didn't want the radio on. If I tried to put the radio on because it was horrible, sitting next to your father in a car on the way to work, it was going to be a horrible day in a disgusting market all day long, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want to go to begin with, but I didn't say anything. Okay, he needed me there. That was the way it was done. I didn't have any option anyway. It was like a little prison camp. But all right, so you sit in the right seat like a dummy, your hands folded on your lap, and nothing, not a word, mum. The whole ride. BQE, the Kosciuszko Bridge, the stink of the pork dying there, the Trun's meat market, where the eye goes out. You think that you ran over a skunk, but there are no skunks in Williamsburg. That packing plant in August was enough. You talk about a weapon of mass destruction. The Trun's meat packing plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, in the 50s, was a WMD. That's why rents were low in those days. The floors were cockeyed with linoleum, that when a dog would urinate in the bedroom, it would run into the living room because the floors were old. But that's the way it was. No one complained. Today you got the same losers who can't live in Manhattan. They live there now. They discovered the charm of Williamsburg. Oh, I really love it over here. It's really great. You know, it's right near the overpass, and I like the factory area. Nobody ever wanted to live there. Even when it was in its heyday, nobody wanted to live there. But the point I'm making is a little different. So if you sit in the car, you're next to your father driving to work, and you know you can't say anything. There's nothing to say. He's grim. He's white. His hands are white-knuckled on the wheel because he's gone in again another horrible day to make a living. Nothing was fun. Nobody worked in those days for fun. This was an evolution of the Dr. Spock generation. Oh, find what's fun and pursue it. Pursue what's fun. To my father, nothing was fun. It was grim. Horrible. It was like Grimm's fairy tales. Came over, work, drop dead, and move on. It's in the ground. In the ground. That's it. Next case. Next generation. There was no fun. From another world, they didn't know what the word fun was. So he's driving to work. The hands are like white knuckles. And I'm sitting here. So my hand reaches, the left hand reaches for the radio dial, like to punch a button in. No, no radio. So what do you mean no radio? I don't want music. Why? Never mind why. This is not entertainment. It's work. So, all right. So work has to be torture. I get it. All right. That's why I'm in the radio business. I was made for this. What I'm getting at is he didn't like cute. If he saw people, and I'm the same way, unfortunately, I become him in essence. This is how it is. All the years I resisted becoming him, I came, a long time ago I became my father. I admit it. There must be something to it. Worked for him. It's worked for me so far. But he didn't like cute, people who talk cute to the children. You know, the guy was 100% right. Let's say I'm talking generally, 9 out of the 10 couples did not talk to their children in because it was like embarrassing. Anyone who did that, the child either wound up in San Francisco wearing a pink set of tights at 19 expressing himself, or the girl wound up married to her sorority sister. 9 out of 10, they never wound up okay. None of them became anything. That's true because of the liberal upbringing. Liberalism not only is a mental disorder, but it destroys children. You need to raise children the old-fashioned way. I don't say hurt them. I never got hit. He didn't hit me. Just verbal abuse. It worked better.
Savage.
Now we're going to talk about the man who sued IBM over adult chat room firing. A man who was fired by IBM for visiting an adult chat room at work is suing the company for $5 million, claiming he's an internet addict who deserved treatment and sympathy rather than dismissal. James Pakenza, 58, of Montgomery, whatever that is, says he visits chat rooms to treat traumatic stress incurred in 1969 when he saw his best friend killed during an army patrol in Vietnam. Now, I don't know how going to a chat room about sex helps that, but in papers filed in federal court in White Plains, New York, Pacenza said the stress caused him to become, quote, a sex addict. And with the development of the internet and internet addict, he's now claiming protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act. His lawyer, Michael Diedrich, said Pacenza never visited porno sites at work. He violated no written IBM rule and did not surf the internet any more or any differently than any other employee.
He also says age discrimination contributed to IBM's actions. Piacenza, 55 at the time, had been with the company for 19 years and says he could have retired in a year. IBM has asked Judge Stephen Robinson for summary judgment, saying his policy against surfing sexual websites is very clear. It also claims Piacenza was told he could lose his job after an incident 4 months earlier, which Piacenza denies. Company says plaintiff was discharged by IBM because he visited an internet chat room for sexual experience during work after he had been previously warned. IBM also said sexual behavior disorders are specifically excluded from the ADA and denied any age discrimination. That's very interesting. That is very, very interesting to claim, traumatic stress disorder caused him to look at porn, and now he's an addict, a sex addict, and he should do what he wants? Come on, who's going to buy this? I don't believe it at all. What I believe here is going to happen is the lawyer is simply bargaining with IBM to try to get them to pay his pension and to withdraw the lawsuit. If I were IBM, I'd take him to court and I'd throw the bum out. It looks to me like if you work for a company, the law is very clear. You cannot use the company computer to go onto chat rooms if it says so in the manual. You can't visit sex sites if it says so in the manual. You don't own that computer. You can't do that at work. Now to come and retroactively say, "Oh, I'm an internet addict. I'm a sex addict. I deserve treatment and sympathy." Rubbish. No one's going to buy it. He said that he went on a chat talk to divert his attention from thoughts of Vietnam and death. You hear this rubbish? He says, "I was tempting myself to perhaps become involved in some titillating conversation." Come on. Come on. I don't buy this at all. Psychiatric treatment? I don't know what I want to do. I feel like I laid on the beach at Coney Island. I stay out of the sun because I had the skin cancer removed about 8 times already. In the temple area from the early years, from in the sun when my mother thought getting color was good for me. Go in the sun, get color. I would come back like a lobster. Good, you look good.
In the summertime when the weather is hot, you can stretch right up and touch the sky. When the weather's fine, you got women on your mind.
They were laying down a cancer in the skin. How did they know? They didn't mean anything by it. They didn't know. They didn't have a knowledge of it then. The same with the food. You know, the heavy food in the morning. Eggs and steak for dinner and meatloaf for lunch. Did they really know they were killing their son? They wouldn't have done it, I don't think. Do you think maybe they were doing it on purpose to get rid of the males? Sometimes I think that generation of women was like a female cult. They got married only to have a daughter. The son they could have done without, and the husband. Then the Viagra came along. Thank God many of them passed away before that. Could you imagine that? That the man loses the ability just at the right point when the woman doesn't really want him anymore to do that. Now all of a sudden, bing, they got Viagra going around. A guy could be any age. Suddenly he's like he's got a glint in his eye and he's stalking her all over the house and she don't want nothing to do with the guy. It's like a curse for a middle-aged woman. You know, you think every woman wants to do this? They don't. Most of them leave it behind them at a certain point. But in those days, the women gave it up after, like, the second child. They had sex twice. 2 children, that was it. God didn't want them to enjoy themselves because they never did enjoy it. Would you have enjoyed it either if your husband was like a furrier and weighed 350 pounds and looked like Gerald Nadler? You know, and that's how it was set up. Most of you don't know who Gerald Nadler is. You got to leave him alone. He lost a lot of weight. Now, I'm not making any allegations at all, but, you know, I saw something shocking. In his heyday, Gerald Nadler, the heavyset kind, that's how we used to say fat in my day, heavyset. Or night, they used to say he's light on his feet. That meant for a fat guy, he didn't collapse altogether when he danced. But Gerald Nadler used to be really a hefty, heavy guy. Then all of a sudden, he went on some diet. Now he's like only doubly overweight. He's 150% of normal body weight for a man his size instead of 300%. There was a character in The Sopranos, remember? I forget his name. Is it Spatafori? The one who, no allegations at all, but he also lost weight, remember? This is the Savage Nation. To this day, if you drive through, if you drive from L.A. to Ventura, it's one of the most astounding things in the world to see the orange groves. They're still there. You know, that's where they shoot a lot of the old L.A. scenes. They drive you on that road, the Ventura Freeway, off the Ventura Freeway. And you see those orange groves. They're astounding. It's heartbreaking when they go down for a house. In Northern California, you live here, you see like plowed under. One housing development after the San Joaquin Valley. Millions of years of evolution. Ice age. Alluvial plain. Soil. The vegetable basket of the world. And then you see plowed under. When I see a cherry orchard, or a pear orchard. I'm driving up on Highway 80 up to Lake Tahoe. And it's like I pray every time I take the ride it's not going to be like knocked down. Those rows of trees, you know, like generations of farmers. Nice people, raised children. One generation, two. Then the third generation doesn't want to raise the trees anymore. They want to cash in. You don't blame them. And it breaks their heart, but they take the $200 million for the land and they forget Grandpa. They have his ashes somewhere. They forgot where they put the ashes. They're off at Acapulco, wherever they went. Who knows? You know, Acapulco's coming back. I'm not out of it. It's coming back, making a comeback, Acapulco. It's like everything comes back. It's like Miami. For a long time, oh, you don't go to Miami. Now a lot of people like Miami. Cuban food, the beans, whatever. But, you know, you used to laugh when you say Acapulco because it was one of the first big cities. Today it's coming back. Maybe we'll do a tour, like a savage tour of Acapulco. Maybe we can... maybe we can go cross the border into Mexico without our birth certificates or licenses. See what happens. What if we did a reverse thing as tourists, like 1,000 of us cross the border into Mexico? See what would the Mexicans give us, like water and condoms and stuff, like they do coming in here? All the Good Samaritans? Would they give us like a survival kit or would they shoot us? I mean, Vicente Fox is big on telling us we got to treat their illegal aliens. Why don't we try to sneak into Mexico and see what happens? See how they treat us. The electrons. Who wants to sneak into Mexico, man? You never get out. It's like traffic. Every time I go to Mexico, I feel like it's like traffic. You make one wrong move, you know you're going to be tortured somewhere. I don't go there for that reason. Well, Cancun is different. That's like an enclave. Nothing could ever go wrong there. You're protected. It's like Mulberry Street. Cancun is like the Mulberry Street of Mexico. I mean, when organized crime ran that area, you know you could go there at Christmas, leave your car unlocked, because they were into crime. They were bad people, but they knew it was good for the restaurants and the general area. They had the old men in the doors, you know, always with the eyes, touching with the pinkies. And so nobody would rob in that neighborhood. They'd get killed. That's what Cancun is to Mexico. It's like the Mulberry Street of Mexico. It really is. I like to goof around a little bit because, after all, radio is primarily an entertainment medium, and you got to keep people interested. You know, people get distracted easily. They can listen to music, sports, this and that. So if they are doing me the privilege and the honor of listening to my show, I got to deliver on the goods. And let me tell you, at the end of the day, they got to know that they got value for the money of listening. That's what it comes down to. It may not cost anything to listen to a radio show, but I actually ask myself every day, you know, did I perform? Did I give them their money's worth? Otherwise, they don't listen. Why would you listen? Why would I listen to a show if I didn't get something out of it? Well, I have to just get a laugh. I can get a laugh anywhere, you know.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from August 2010 from the Savage Nation.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. Here is the best of the Savage Nation from August 2010. I'm going to tell you about the dish I cooked last night, star flounder, and how I cooked it. There's a fish store nearby, a meat and fish store. I love the store. I'd give the name for free, and let the guy, but I can't, because then you'll know where I shop and you'll look for me there, and you'll poison the fish, so I can't give you the name of it. But the guy has really good stuff. He specializes in good meats, and he ships them around the country, and he gets great fish. So he knows I like Petrali sole. You know, filet of sole, but it's called Petrali sole out here in California, Northern California. So he didn't have any yesterday. So he said, I got something better. I have star flounder. I said, what's star flounder? He said, try it. You like it. So I said, and I trust him. So I bought it. I cooked this fish. Well, first of all, it starts with smelling the fish. I told you I had an aunt, God rest her soul, who would go into a butcher store in the summer wearing a fur coat into the freezer to, because she knew the butcher was a crook and that he would switch meats on her in the freezer. Remember that story about my aunt, God rest her soul? It was a hot August day up in the Catskill Mountains, Moishe's butcher shop. I hope his descendants are not listening. And she'd pick out a steak in the cabinet in the front, the case, the best, most expensive steak. And she'd say, grind it up for me, make it chopped meat. Don't worry, he'd say to her, I'll be back. And he'd go in the freezer. She always knew he went in the freezer. So sure enough, she'd bring an overcoat and go in the freezer with him, because she knew he'd switch meats and give him pre-ground chuck. She was right. She wasn't paranoid. I was a butcher boy that summer. I delivered meats. He would go in the bin. Whatever they picked, he put on the top shelf, and he'd come out with the pre-grade, turn the grinder on, and nothing would go in the grinder. And then he would take the meat. He had pre-ground the chuck meat, and he'd bring it out and show it to them with a smile. Take a look at this meat. So she knew better than to. But anyway, the point is, she went into a restaurant, which she never did in her entire life. She didn't trust restaurants. She was from the old country. They looked down on people who ate in restaurants. Could you imagine the day and age I grew up in? They actually, I had amazing relatives. They didn't trust restaurants. They thought it was junk. What do you eat that garbage in restaurants for? They assumed all food restaurants was garbage. Only a home-cooked meal was good. They were probably right, but anyway, in those days, they didn't go to restaurants. They didn't trust them. Somehow they felt that only like dumb people who drank a lot ate in restaurants. Usually like wasps who didn't know food to begin with. They were all drunk anyway, so they fed them the worst food in like the Park Hotel on Fifth Avenue. They didn't know what they were eating because they were pickled on gin or whatever. So they looked down at anyone who went to a restaurant. The point is that whatever she ate, she smelled it first like an animal, but she was right. So I picked that habit up, and people think I'm nuts. So if I go in a restaurant, I say to them, okay, I'll have the fish, bring it out first. They won't do it. They won't bring the fish out. Because you got to smell the fish. Otherwise, how do you know how old it is? What do you think sauces are? Ladies and gentlemen, wake up. You know, today, all the cooking today consists of is taking bad food and doctoring it up with trick dressings in order to cover up the fact that it's not prime food. That's the whole reason. Because really good food doesn't need a sauce on it to begin with. Now, the French need a sauce on everything because their food is terrible. Their food is so bad, everything is inferior. The meats are inferior, the fish is inferior, but they learned through the centuries after Napoleon got his butt kicked how to make sauces to cover up for the fact that all of their food was inferior to the Italians. You know, because if you look at the Italians, they do have sauces, but not like the French with the trick sauces. You know how I always said I like dogs, but I don't like cats? Dogs are overt and cats are covert. I don't like covert anything. I like everything up front. If a dog growls, I know it's growling. Cat's sneaky, but it always, it's like it makes in a box in a house. You don't know where it is. I don't like that. A dog is up front. You know, they walk. Even the way they walk, they're out there. They're out there. It's the same with cuisine. Italian food is like dog-like. It's out there. It's overt. French food is always covert. It's sneaky. There's always something sneaky about it. I get the star flounder home last night after the show. I was in a cook-at-home mood. Now, don't get me wrong. I eat in restaurants all the time, but I cook at home once in a while. I was in the mood to cook at home. So I get the star flounder. I open the package, and you put your nose right on the fish. It smelled of the sea. It smelled like fish smelled to me. When I once lived in Marblehead, Massachusetts in the 1970s. I was researching a book, and I was living in Marblehead and commuting to the herbarium up at Harvard, the Harvard Herbarium. I remember a whole winter I spent there. And I used to get fish from the fishing boats down at the, believe it or not, right from the boats. And this is what the fish smell like. It was that good from Monterey. So anyway, here's what you do. It's simple. It reminded me of the years I lived in Spain. How hard is it to cook a piece of fish? Not hard at all. You wash it, you dry it. You don't need salt and pepper on it. I don't know what the obsession is. I watched that chef on the air. As I said, my mother would have thrown him out of her four-burner kitchen. And the chef says, oh, you got to put a little salt and a little pepper on it. He rolled so much salt in it, you needed a hypertension pill. What's this with the obsession? Fish already has salt in the flesh. You get oil very hot. Now, I mean very hot, but I don't mean sizzling, because the fish will burn immediately. You got to get it hot, but not burning. That means hot, but not burning. That means hot enough that when you put the flesh in there, it's going to cook immediately, not suck up the oil. And then, and I don't mean an inch thick of oil either. You're not deep frying that fish. But you need it to be deep enough that it covers the fish, but not soaks the fish. So everything has a subtlety to it. So you get the oil hot. You slide the fish fillets in there. You do 3 minutes on one side. And then you turn it over. You do 2 minutes on the other. And that's the genius. That's the cooking recipe. Now, nobody in the restaurant business will agree with me. Because you don't make a living just cooking a good piece of fish in oil. You have to trick it with sauces. My dog, Teddy, just came back from the groomer. He looks so sweet. Right now, his coat is still clean. I take him for one walk. He needs another bath. I still don't understand a dog like this. I've had every kind of dog in the world. This one, you walk him down a street, he doesn't miss a bush, a pump, a pole, a can. You have to drag him along, and he rubs against it. That's the part I don't mind how he relieves himself. That's his business. He's a dog. I'm not. That's his genetic problem. But that he rubs against it, I don't understand. He ruins the guy almost has to wear a raincoat to take him for a walk. I don't walk my dog. I hate walking my dog. It's one of my least I don't like walking a dog. It makes me very depressed. If I go out, I like to ride a bicycle. So today I rode my bicycle to the mall, and I like to look at the people. Even though it's a small snapshot of suburban white middle America, it's still a snapshot of America. As a talk show host, you're basically living in your own world like a painter. Truthfully, or anyone who works at home alone, if you don't see people, you can go out of your mind, you can go crazy, and you can start to distort reality. So I go to this place. I try to go once a day to one mall or another, or walk the streets of San Francisco. I got to see people, or I go nuts. So I see a woman go by with two beautiful children. They must have been a year old in the car, a double carriage. So I stopped and I said to her, oh, are they twins? I didn't even think, should I say it or not say it? Because you live in an age where if you say to someone, are they twins, they can call the police and say, you're something wrong with them. He stopped me and asked me if they're twins. So I didn't even think. They were so beautiful. I stopped and I said, oh, are they twins? And she said, yes. And she was so happy to tell me their names, Anastasia and Joey, a boy and a girl. You know what I said to her? You're a very lucky woman. And then as I walked on, I thought about something. When I was a kid, again, when I was a kid, people would stop women with babies and admire the babies and look at them and talk about them. And the mother felt good. You know, it's very hard being a young mother. It's one of the hardest things on earth. Their bodies have changed. They, other than the supermodel who gained 4 ounces after pregnancy, most women's bodies get wrecked from pregnancy. So a woman goes through hell during pregnancy and afterwards. Believe me. So I didn't do it for the woman. I did it because I was stopped. The children were amazingly interesting and beautiful. But I thought about what a glow I gave this stranger who I didn't even know. And I thought what a world it could be if people were just human to each other and didn't want something, you know? Whatever. San Diego, Danny, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I just wanted to address your fish comment before, which you were speaking of. As a young boy, I used to fish in Connecticut. I'm originally from Connecticut, and we would fish in a lake called Lake Salt and Saul, and we would catch freshwater bass. And after we would catch the bass, we would cut the bass up, and we would, you know, take the insides out and cook the bass up immediately. And the smell of the bass, when you took it out and you cut it up, did not smell anything like the fish you would buy at a supermarket or anything. It smelled like nature. It smelled tremendous, and it tasted completely different. And now I'm in L.A., and I can't get really anything like that unless I go fishing again. It's just amazing the difference.
Well, no, but I was saying is I go to a certain fish market where the guy gets it literally that day from a fishing boat in Monterey, and it smells like that. You know, you still can buy fresh fish from certain purveyors.
Correct. Yeah, that's.
But, you know, when you go to a restaurant, I have a friend who was once a Sicilian guy, used to be a fisherman. He told me most fish today, even if it's fresh, is at least 2 days old. There's no way to go from a boat to a restaurant in less than 2 days, unless the restaurant is right off the dock. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And I, you know, just brought back memories of me fishing and then slicing the fish up, cooking it right up, eating it, and the huge...
That's right. Well, that's right. It was supposed to have memories, good memories. We all need good memories.
I am syndicated by an independent syndicator who is not in any sense a major corporation. Maybe he will be one day. Maybe he knows them. But you see, Limbaugh and Beck are part of corporate talk. And whether you believe it or not, it doesn't really matter whether the corporate talk is left or right. There is a club. And corporate talk only talks about others within the corporate talk fraternity. And so although Michael Savage has been actually banned in Britain, although Michael Savage is actually the first victim of McCarthyism in this period, although Michael Savage is actually the first victim of such things, that didn't matter to Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. What's important is what might happen to Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, not what actually did happen to Michael Savage. And that's the beauty of it. The beauty is that they can get away with it because the people themselves don't even see the hypocrisy. And now you understand what corporate broadcasting is as opposed to independent broadcasting.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from August 2010 from the Savage Nation. Both in the written word and the spoken word. And where did I come from? How did I do it? And why do you listen to me on a regular basis? And who am I really? Never mind what the rats on the left say about me. Read the New Yorker interview. Of all the things written about me, I'd say the New Yorker interview is the closest thing to who I really am. There's a lot of nuance in Michael that you may not hear because of your own projections. You project your hatreds onto me, so you think I'm something I'm not. And I'm willing to live with it. I'm a public figure, so I have to expect that. Who is M. Savage? Question mark. Savage has summarized his political philosophy. I'm reading the Running Head. Savage has summarized his political philosophy in three words: borders, language, and culture. Some, including Savage himself, have characterized his views as conservative nationalism. Ooh. Savage outspokenly opposes illegal immigration to the United States, supports the English-only movement, and argues that liberalism and progressivism are degrading American culture, period. Although his radio delivery is usually characterized as confrontational and politically themed, some of Savage's show involves ruminating on topics such as medicine, nutrition, music, literature, history, theology, dot, dot, dot. So now you understand the wide appeal of Michael Savage. And that's why, even though you're a liberal, you listen to the show, because you can't get what I do anywhere else. I'm the last Renaissance man in the American media. There is no other. There's not another Renaissance man. I remember when I grew up, I didn't even know what a Renaissance man was. I thought it was a guy who ran around in tights at these English festivals. And, you know, I didn't know what a Renaissance man was. How did I know? So here I am, the last Renaissance man in the American media, holding down the fort every day. And you have to ask yourself, well, how did I get here? Who am I? Who are you? Well, let me go back and tell you a little tidbit. My dad, God rest his soul, owned a little store, a little antique store, in New York's poor Lower East Side. Today it's not poor. Today they have vomit bars on every corner. Every corner they have another yuppie puking on the curb at 3 o'clock in the morning. But when I was a kid, it was a poor neighborhood. There were pickle stores where Elena Kagan belongs and things like that on Essex Street, wearing a dirty apron. And he had a little antique store, so I met every kind of human being known to mankind. It was a market, you see, with 20 different men in it, selling different wares, and they lifted up the stalls and lowered the stalls at night, whatever. So he had 10 different guys, 15, I don't know how many were in there, one woman at a stand. They sold everything in there. So we met a variety of people. Now, given that he was in the antique business, I met a wide variety of New York City's people. In other words, it wasn't just one type of personality. I met a lot of gay people shopped in his store because, as you well know, being in the antique business, there were a lot of gay people in the antique business. So if you think I'm some rube from Nebraska who doesn't understand from yesterday, you're wrong. I grew up around gay people, straight people,
black people, white people, Hispanic people, Asian people. I have to tell you, I never heard a negative word from my father's lips about one race or one gay person in my whole life. That's to start with. But he taught me when I was very, very young to respect all people. Everybody who came in that store, he told me, you don't know who they are, so don't prejudge them. I'll never forget as long as I live. A black man came in, a very well-dressed black man came into the store. And as a white kid from the suburbs, naturally he saw me, you know, look at him like he was a little different. But my father grabbed my hand behind the stand and he cautioned me to just calm down and just watch my actions, in other words. And the man said to my father, how much is that statue over there? My father said, I don't know, $1,200. How much is that one over there? $900. How much is that one over there? $2,200. How much is that? $800. How much is the figure of the little boy with the jug? That was $500. So the guy asked for about 10 minutes. He said, all right, I'll take them all. So my father took me aside after the sale, and the man had left. They shook hands, and he said, well, what did you learn from that? He said, what you learned was is you can't judge anybody by how they look.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Most normal people are in Spain. They're somewhere. Everybody's somewhere. I don't know. Now, don't assume I'm just some grumpy old guy. I mean, I have been in many, many places, some exotic, some pedestrian. I don't get the charge out of travel that most people do, yet I understand the need for travel, to be the idea of going somewhere, you know, to feel like you've and, you know, left your regular day behind. But, you know, when you're in the media and you live on the edge, as we do, if you're doing the right thing here, traveling doesn't do the same thing that it used to do. I mean, you need it if you have a kind of humdrum life. I don't understand it as much. Maybe when I was young, exotic. Well, what's there? But even the world, 30 years ago, there were differences. You go to Spain, you'd see women walking around in black. Now you go there, you see women looking like the same that you see here. Let's be specific. The same clothing everywhere. It's one homogenous blur, the entire world. One homogenous Western blob has descended upon the world from here to Manchuria. The same thing. Everyone wanting to look like a child at Disneyland. So what's the excitement? You trek to Mongolia and see Mongolians wearing the same, the crack outfits that they wear in the streets of a ghetto here with the same, you know, haircuts. So who needs it? I'd rather stay here, whatever. So yesterday I got bored because of that. And I realized that, you know, happiness is within. The kingdom of God is within. It's not out there. I don't have to go to Jerusalem to find God, so to speak. So, you know, it was written years ago, the kingdom of God is within, and the kingdom of happiness is within you also. So I said, you know, you got to make yourself interested in life. Life isn't going to come to you and make you interested, so stop it already. You've been there and you've done this, you've gone in circles. Stop with the boredom talk. I had to whip myself into action. It's like one of those doldrum times, you know, where like I'm becalmed on the sea, the high sea of life in that sense. Because success is a stale finale. I got to admit it to you. I'm not boasting. Eugene O'Neill wrote that. And it's 100% true. The years I was struggling were more interesting in a way than these years. And I'm not begging fate to suddenly cast me down again. But the point I'm saying is success is a stale finale. There's no question about it. Eugene O'Neill wrote that success is a stale finale, as I just said. The struggle is the success. And when you cease to have a reason to struggle, believe me, nature hates a void. Nature abhors a vacuum, as it's been said, and she'll fill that vacuum with something for you to struggle with, whether it be a nice cancer maybe, a little brain tumor, whatever. Go ahead, keep complaining, and you'll have a nice little reward, I say to myself, because I am, man, I look up. I mean, I know that he's up there looking down, and I know you're going to start asking for too much, you know what you get, a good kick in the behind. So I said to myself, all right, stop it already. You love art. So I go to Bonham's Auction Gallery. Lucky for me, it was a gloomy Sunday in San Francisco, and the Bonhams Auction Gallery is coming up with an auction of Western paintings. Now, I don't mean European art. I mean fine paintings of the West, whether it be Indians or cowboy, just really good, really high-end. I'm not talking Dreck art. We're not talking John Nagy. I look online, and I go through maybe 150 paintings, and I found about six that really look good. So, okay, we pack the whole group into the car, dogs and all. We trek over to the homeless encampment down south of Market, near South Van Ness. We pass the shopping cart folks, and we go into the auction gallery. It was a very nice experience. I felt transformed back to my early years of enjoying art and being in my father's antique store and going to museums. And I looked at the paintings very, very closely. They looked better than they did in the catalog, the online catalog, incidentally. Five out of the six did. There was one that struck me as particularly amazing. And it showed a group of, I forget which Indian tribe, you'll have to forgive me, I don't remember which one. It shows them making camp after the first snowfall, where the commentary about it is, it's the first snowfall in the West, you know, some Western range. And this tribe of amazing Native Americans are going out on a hunt after the first snowfall. And they say that the hunt will be very easy because the animal's tracks will be highly visible in that first snowfall. And I think it's called a smokeless fire. These people were such geniuses, the Native Americans, that they could build a fire in the snow with a little lean-to, a smokeless fire. And I'm the kind of guy where I could stare at a painting and get so sucked into it that I'm in there with them, and I'm saying, my God, 20,000 years of living on this continent, and these people not only could live off the land, they had a civilization to go with it. They weren't just simply primitives, you know, grunting. They had a real civilization. A language of their own, a culture of their own, rituals of their own, astoundingly beautiful. But this isn't the first time I've come to that. I wrote a book in 1972 called Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, Native American Remedies, etc. So I've long been an admirer of Native American culture, to be frank with you. This isn't the first. But it's a great painting. It brings you back to the reality of what we're living and how lucky we really are, how lazy we all really are, and how incapable we really are of living on our own, unless you're the rare guy who knows how to hunt and trap. And things of that nature. And I don't know how many of them are left. Don't call me if you are. I appreciate that, you know, that many of you do know how to do it. So here we are, and that's the end of that. And here we are, and I had a bad Chinese meal, overate, almost had the stomach. Oh, that's what I was going to tell you. So I'm in the place, looking at the paintings. Now I wanted to tell you the point of the story. So there's a showcase on the way out with, like, memorabilia, like letters, you know, from the artists. And one of the, I had to tell the audience this, I knew it. I look in the showcase, and it's a letter from 1924 from the artist, one of the famous Western artists, to the client who had purchased a painting for, I don't know, $75 at the time. And the artist writes a beautiful letter in beautiful handwriting, unlike today where they have hieroglyphics, they text, they can't even write their name. He writes a gorgeous letter in blue ink to the buyer. And he said, enclosed is the bill. And I wanted to make this as beautiful as the painting. And so herewith is the enclosed. And he did a painting on the letter, on the bill, to the buyer. So I'm staring at this saying, why, my God, what a world this was of civility. And there were a group of gay men in the place. And we had a nice conversation. They loved my dog. And there was a different kind of group than you see the rabble here in San Francisco. This is the type of guys I grew up with in New York, much more civilized. Gay or straight didn't matter. You know, they talked to us because they loved the dog, and they said he looks like a little lion. You know, it was a different world, the kind I grew up in, as opposed to the rabble out here who think that they're wild because they have green hair and a ring in their nose. These guys were very nice. I'm leaning over the case, and one of these gay guys comes over, man in their middle age, and looks in, and I said, my God, look at the letter. And he says, look at that letter. And I said, isn't it amazing the time, the 20s, that an artist would write, I wanted to make this as beautiful as the painting? And he paints another painting on the bill for the buyer. And he says, yes, yes, yes. And I said, yep, an age of dignity. And he said, that's exactly the word, isn't it? That's all a little snapshot of a day. Nothing profound. I burned my palm at Starbucks. I have that story to tell. I'm sitting here with it sprayed with some goo lucky I had in the closet here at the radio studio. Why in the hell do they make coffee so hot? Why is it when I go in for coffee, when I say, give me a small coffee, they always get a moron who says tall coffee, and I say, no, I said small coffee. And the moron will repeat again, since it's the Bay Area, filled with the biggest schmucks on earth, tall coffee, I said small coffee. And she looks at me with the clipped hair and the mean face, another moron they hired, and says, tall, small, it's all the same. I said, then why can't you call it what it is? Just give me a cup of coffee, will you please? She gives me the cup of coffee. I give her a tip because I tip fast food workers everywhere. Unfortunately for me, she left the top loose on it. I grabbed the cup, and it spilled on my left hand and burnt my palm. I didn't say anything. I'm not a liberal. I'm not going to sue. I know some of you are out-of-work lawyers who can't get a job with Obama, and you'd like my phone number. It's 1-800-449-8255. And I burnt my palm at Starbucks, and I'm not going to sue. But I do have an attorney on the line. Charlie from Tampa, welcome to the show.
Hey, hello, Michael. Yeah, I was listening to your show, and I understand you have a severe third-degree burn possibly on your hand. And
I really do. I don't sue, but I'm pissed off because they make the coffee so hot. First of all, why didn't she put the lid on tight enough that when I picked it up to carry it across the floor, I spilled it on the palm of my hand. I burned my hand. It turned red. I mean, luckily I came to the studio and I have a spray, you know, with benzocaine in it, and the pain went away. But the hand's red. The palm is red. It'll smart for a few days.
You know, something like that, Michael's worth probably $1 million, maybe $500,000.
Ah, come on. You couldn't get a mill for a burn like this.
Well, you being a celebrity, maybe we can even up that a little bit. You're right. Maybe $4 or $5 million.
I'll tell you what. You know what? I'd put every dime into my Savage legal fund, and any money that's left over goes to a scholarship anyway.
Well, as a tort attorney, I don't even need a good reason to sue. I just got to think I can make some money, sir. You know what I mean? Hey, it's a...
Well, I don't know how you can do it in good conscience, but I'm burned with guilt and a conscience. I was raised with a guilt complex, so I'm afraid to sue for nothing, you know.
Well, no, that's a good cause because you're severely, could be handicapped for life now.
Come on.
Now BP's going to be sued because Charlie Crist opened the door for the homeowners to sue him now, so it's going to be an endless process. We are a litigious society.
They got cops in New York who are living on disability, 75% of a full salary, no taxes. Now they want to add mental stress so they can get even more money out of the taxpayer on a higher Social Security disability pension. It's shocking to me. You know and I know that this is going to come to an end, these gravy train contracts that the unions wrote. They're going to revise all of them. You know that.
Hey, I need to go out and make as much money as I can before our country falls.
Well, what are you putting your money into, though? Spanish pesos, or where are you investing it?
Oh, gold bullion.
You're in bullion? Well, so let's say, when it all comes down, do you really think that we're going to trade, like, chips of bullion with each other for, like, white bread or something?
Well, the dollar's not going to be worth nothing, so I might as well have something that's I can hold on to. That and my gun.
Well, I hear they're thinking of changing the dollar bill and putting Obama on it. You know, it's going to be called the Obama rather than the dollar. And what's a dollar now will be worth a penny, but it'll be made of paper.
Oh boy, we'll be buying yen before long, I guess.
Yeah, the yen. We'll be using yen in the streets. I have a yen for some yen. How much is a scald like this worth on the hand, on the palm?
Well, you know, if we talk to your, the insurance company, I'm sure we can settle something out of court, something that we can use for your legal funds.
Yeah, and then I would get on the air and I'd say, I didn't do it for the money. I did it so that the next poor person doesn't scald their hand, right? I do one of those speeches.
Well, next time they can check, teach these ninth grade dropouts how to put a lid on properly.
I couldn't believe it. She did it on purpose, too, because I dared say small instead of tall.
You know what? It's probably a hate crime because she knew who you were, Michael.
Well, she may have known. I saw the clipped hair and the mean face do a double clock. It's certainly possible.
Savage.
Here in San Francisco, a cold wave we've had like this. I haven't seen anything like this in 40 years I've lived out here. It's like nuclear winter out here. Every day, cold, cold, cold. So today we had a little sun. Finally, it looks a little bit like a bit of a summer. I haven't had one barbecue all summer, thank God. Only my schmuck neighbor. He'd have one in the rain. Just to spite me, he has a barbecue. I hope he doesn't get what the other neighbor got from barbecuing every day, a little stomach cancer. Who eats barbecued food every day of their life if they have an education beyond the first grade? These people are like Bronze Age people I live near in Marin County, California, like from the Bronze Age. The heaths. You know where the word heathen comes from? Barbecues and fireplaces. That's heathens. Every day, like burnt meat. Every day, a piece of burnt meat. He doesn't know that it's benzoapyrenes are going to give him a stomach cancer. Every day, a burnt, like a hunter-gatherer up there with the fire. He discovered fire. Fire, good. Burnt meat, very good. Not going to get cancer. No, it disturbs my neighbor. Make more fire. Fire, good. Go ahead. God sees the truth, but wait, see if I care. While I'm eating my tofu and beans, you eat your burnt meat. That's all. Don't call me about any of this. Nothing. Nothing. There's nothing I want to hear from you for. What are you going to say that I haven't said already? You know, what are you going to tell me what I know?
Oh, God, look what I have to do for a living. I should have been a tailor. I could have sat in front of a treadle, not talked to anybody, just smoked Philip Morris and died at 47. Poor grandpa. Didn't have a chance. Came over, brought the family over one by one from Europe. He ate his heart out in that tailor store on the Lower East Side. Made suits for guys, nice suits. Never got anywhere. Well, he owned his own store. He moved up. But he didn't have to talk to people like I do 3 hours a day, eating his heart out. I don't know. They all died so young. They had easier jobs than me. Why they dropped dead? I can't understand. It had to be the cigarettes. Don't say stress, because my stress level is 10 times worse than theirs. So don't give me that stress garbage. Mine is 100 times worse. I should have been dead at 11 with my personality and my consciousness. Stress is Look, I study this. The reason I went into nutrition and herbal medicine and looked for the searches all over the world and wrote all those books is because everyone died young in my family from heart attacks. And stress has almost nothing to do with coronary artery disease. Nothing. Zero. Don't believe a word of it. Life is stress by definition. Don't you understand that? And the more you struggle against stress, the more stressed out you are. Just accept that stress is life. And when you die, you have no stress. You know what I mean? Or if you move to Queens, one or the other. The point I'm making is stress has almost nothing to do with it. It's 90%. Okay, let me tell you what I've discovered and what the medical literature says. And please don't call me on this. We all know it anyway, but let me just say it again. It's about one-third, one-third, one-third for any disease. One-third genetics, one-third environment, and one-third unknown. There's an unknown factor in disease. Don't you understand that yet? I learned this in graduate school when I was going for my PhD. I'll never forget my professor. He was a medical doctor and a PhD, and he said to me, you know, he says, I've opened up people at autopsy who've died of heart attacks whose arteries are perfectly clean. Now, that's a mind blower. No occlusion. You know, Lipitor and garlic and vitamin, nothing. The arteries were clean like a baby, and they dropped dead of a heart attack anyway. So there's a mystery to disease. You understand that there's a mysterious element to disease, as there is to so much else in life. There's a mystery to love. There's a mystery to life. Not everything is so cut and dried. So that's what I say. It's a third environment, which means smoking, exercise, nutrition, eating. A third genetics, where you have nothing. You can't do anything about it. And then a third mystery. Now, since you can't affect your genetics, you can't affect your unknowns, you work on the others. That's all. You don't eat like a pig. That's all. You eat like a sane person who wants to live, and you take mega doses of vitamin E and vitamin C and all of the other B vitamins that you need to know, and you got to learn all of that stuff. And then you pray a lot. You pray to God every night that you don't drop dead and leave your children without a father at a very early age. Just everyone in their 30s, 18 times a day, they're touching their chest. Oh, yeah, that's it. They're driving in the car. How many guys listening to this show are laughing right now? They're driving. They're in their 30s. I imagine this because I know it. It was like the 30s are the worst age in life. In the 20s, you're still like, I'm not going to live forever. Nothing's going to affect me. You're in the post-teenage years. Nothing. Then in the 30s, you get the first gray hairs. You get a little flab on your stomach. And every day, if you're married and have children, I mean, if not, well, you can get away with another 10 years. Every day in your 30s, you're driving. Oh, what's that twinge? Oh, and you're sure you're going to go off on the side of the road upside down. You're going to be an embarrassment to your family, dying a horrendous death from the big one. So many guys in their 30s. But let me tell you something. It gets easier as you get older. Because once you realize you are going to die, it doesn't matter. You realize that, you know, don't freak out over it. 40s are easier. Then the 50s are even easier yet. What do I know? Depends upon if you're lucky or not. You don't get sick. My mentors are guys like 80 who aren't, those have anything wrong with them. Still chasing women at 80. There are still men around like this? Astonishing. Okay, rock and roll. I want some rock and roll, real rock and roll. Give me some real rock and roll right now on the Savage Nation.
Heart and soul.
I love being with you. I love talking with you. I love talk radio. I love the business that I'm in. I love the fact that we're the last link between you and the abyss. If it wasn't for talk radio and the internet, we would be in the abyss of communism. Because as sure as I'm sitting here, Obama and his cronies want to drag us into a world that the Chinese and the Russians left behind. As sure as I'm sitting here, that's where they want to go. These are far-left dangerous ideologues, but I'm not going to waste my time telling you what you already know, because you've heard it enough times to know it's true. So let's focus on the media that put this imposter in the White House. Newsweek, Time, you name it. They told you, they sold you a bill of goods. He was a genius. He was a messiah. He was the man who was going to save America and bring us together. He drove us apart. So here we are.
Savage.